You know, we look at what God would have us to do in a fundamental way in this life. God is love, His nature is love, and His nature is supposed to become our nature as well. A natural extension of that, when we look at the family unit, there's two elements in the family. One is the raising of the children, and one is the marriage relationship. But child rearing could be stated as simply as learning how to love a child. That's what child rearing is. It's learning how to properly express love for a child. Marriage is learning how to properly express love for your mate. It's as simple as that. God is love, and what we do in His family is to express that in a proper way. The family is the institution God gave us for those processes to take place. You know, we're trying to give Megan and Derek opportunity to learn various games and sports. We've tried to get them a tennis racket and a soccer ball and a basketball and a couple of gloves and let them begin to participate. And we want them to begin to learn to play on a team. Yesterday they had a t-ball game, and it was the first time they had ever played in that kind of a team environment that, at least that I'm aware of. They've done different things and different activities, but they were on a team, and it was fun to watch them stand up and bat and run around the bases and stand out in field and watch the ball go between their legs and, you know, go out there and just have a good time, but participate in a team in that way. If God is love, and we know that He is, and if that's what He ultimately wants us to do, then what is the team? What is the means whereby He gave us for that process to take place? It's the family. It's the same thing. It's a skill that we learn in the family environment. Now, that's ideally what God intended, and that's ideally what ought to then take place. The family is very, very important. It's been commented on many different times. President Reagan, when he was president, commented during National Family Week, he says, "Strong families are the foundation of society. Through them, we pass on our traditions, rituals, and values. From them, we receive the love, encouragement, and education needed to meet human challenges. Family life provides opportunities and time for the spiritual growth that fosters generosity of spirit and responsible citizenship." How do our kids learn to function and cope in this society? Well, it needs to be in the family, not on the street. It needs to be through their parents and their brothers and their sisters, not by the kids that they work with at school. They need to have the focus coming from where they start. President Johnson, when he was president before that, commented on the family in a very similar way. He said, "Unless we work to strengthen the family, to create conditions under which most parents will stay together, unless we produce an environment that encourages the family stability, all the rest, the schools, the playgrounds, public assistance, private concerns, will never be enough to cut completely the circle of despair and deprivation." He says, you cannot publicly address the family problems. They must be addressed in the families themselves. We are trying to build and strengthen families in a society where the family is under attack. I grew up in Oregon, and in Oregon from time to time we would go to the beach. And because the water was so cold, you didn't play in the water, you played on the beach. But we'd build sandcastles, and it was kind of fun. I mean, we were in high school at the time, but we used to build sandcastles. And, you know, it's an amazing thing. You can work with that sandcastle, and you build them when the tide's out. And then you stand back and the tide comes rushing in and it absolutely just obliterates the castle from the beach. You would never know that it had ever been there. You can go to that same beach, the exact same place, and you can build a pier. A pier is designed to stand fast in the midst of that sand and never move again. To support its weight, to support its structure, to perform a service and a function, it's in the same place. You can build a sandcastle that washes away. You can build a pier that will never move, at least in the short term, again, in the same very exact spot. The difference is knowing how to do it and what to do and when. Families need to be, in that sense, like a pier. God intended our families to be strong. He intended our families to be a place of refuge. Go to the beach. What do you want to do when the storm blows in? Sit in the sandcastle or tie yourself to the pier? Same place. Simply built different than some way else. Matthew 7 and verse 24 makes this very analogy in a very similar way. Matthew 7:24. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken to a wise man who built his house on the rock. The analogy goes back now to using wisdom and applying wisdom in a right and proper way. The rain descends, the floods come, the winds blow and beat on the house, but it doesn't fall because it's founded on a rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them is not wise, doesn't apply the principles, is like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. Rain descends, the floods come, the winds blow, beat on the house, and it falls. It says, and great is the fall. A family can indeed be built in such a way that great is the fall. Or a family can be built in such a way that it stands up to the beating and the weathering and the trauma over time. You know what the illegitimate birth rate in this country is now? It's over 30%. It's about a third. That's the combined birth rate. Areas in this country that have concentrated poverty and social decline have illegitimate birth rates of over 70%. 70%. Over that, maybe three-quarters of all births are outside of that family environment. And they've done studies to show that the crime rate increases accordingly. As the rate of illegitimacy goes up, as the rate of the family breakdown accelerates, and the crime rate ascends on the same graph. It's a tragic thing. You can build a house on sand, you can build a house on rock, you can build a family like a pier and have it stand fast, or it'll wash away if you build it wrong. Robert Bork, in his book Slouching Towards Gomorrah, addresses our social decline. He says there has been a long developing weakening of cultural constraint. He says constraints in our society that are going to be very hard to put back in place. You ever hung a picture on the wall, maybe on sheetrock, where you drilled a little hole and you ran your screw in? And then said, well, you know, I need to move that a quarter of an inch. You know what it takes to move that a quarter of an inch? I mean, if you missed it and you didn't get it right where you want it to move it just a little bit, you know, you got to fill that in, you got to start over, you got to run that. I mean, it takes work. Robert Bork is just saying, in this society, there are things that are coming loose, that are being taken down, they're going to be very hard to put back up. Because they're damaged in the process, and you can't just stick them back on the wall. It's not as simple as that. He also states that we are creating a whole generation of children who are less happy, less physically and mentally healthy, less equipped to deal with life or produce at work, and more dangerous to themselves and others. We're producing a generation that is unhappy, and is going to make us unhappy too. You know, there's places in Spokane where you can still let your children run out and play. Some of you are in circumstances where that's an incredible thing, and it's a blessing. But, you know, there's so many places where you can't. I live in a nice part of Spokane. Our children don't play in the front yard without our supervision. They don't play in our own front yard unless we are visibly, physically there watching. We're just simply not going to do it. We've lived in too many places and read too many stories of kids in the towns where we lived were picked up and taken. It's not something that we heard about across the country. It's not something we read about just in the news. It's somebody we could go right there and say, yes, here was the place. It's simply not going to happen if we can help it. Robert Bork's comments aren't exactly a rousing cheer for the status of the American family. Family that we have a chance to participate in, those in the church. And we have the Word of God, and we have His instruction, and we have His Spirit to work our mind, to open our mind, to strengthen our resolve. That doesn't mean our circumstances are always easy. Some here in this room have circumstances that are very, very difficult indeed, but we must understand what the purpose of the family truly is. The family is that institution that God designed and created for us to use so that we might learn to express His love for our mate and for our children as well. But it takes a little bit of knowledge to put that in place. It's not just absolutely randomly done. When I was in Boy Scouts, we used to go out on hikes and camp outs and do various things, and I really enjoyed that. I have always had a love of adventure. Not that I have had so much adventure, but I've had an absolute love for it. We decided as scouts that we would go camp in the snow one winter. that we would go out with snowshoes and camp out in the middle of a big field of snow and make huts and igloos and have quite a time of it. And so we got all geared up and ready to go, and we hauled out there with our packs and our snowshoes, and we walked out in the middle of a field out in the mountains in Oregon, and we set to work to build our camp. I thought this was a big lark, and so we decided, a friend of mine and I, to build a party igloo big enough to have the other scouts come join us that night, and we could sit up, maybe play cards or tell jokes or stories or something. And so we set to work. Well, the day wore on, and as it began to get dark, it wasn't too hard to see that we only had a wall built up around 2.5 feet tall around us, and there was no top on it. That was a large wall, and it covered a lot of ground, but there was no top. Nobody told us that anybody who wants to build that kind of a shelter in the snow needs to make it real small so they just barely crawl inside. We were making a hotel. Well, in desperation, we tried to get some branches, cover one corner of the top, and were able to kind of shelter one little section of it, maybe a fourth of the opening on the top, and then as it got dark, we had no choice but to finally go to bed. This friend of mine and I laid down, it began to snow. We're laying out here with a windbreak and a snowstorm, and the snow's landing right on top of our sleeping bags, coming straight down on us. We were boys, but we weren't shy at all. We both got into the same sleeping bag because we were freezing to death, it seemed like it. Crawled in together, hugged and cuddled up the best that we could and didn't feel a bit shy. As the night wore on, as uncomfortable as that was, and with two of us in the bag slid off of the tarp that it was on. It kept us dry from the bottom, and the warmth and the body heat on one side of the bag melted the snow and soaked through, so one side of the bag got wet. So now about every half hour we had to roll around, change who got to sleep on the wet side and who slept on the dry side. And we spent the night that way in cramps and fits of cold, and boy, I tell you, at the first little crack of any sign of daylight, we were out of there, built the fire, and were stormed up and ready to go. Next year, crazy as we were, we decided to do that again. Boy Scouts got together and said, we're going to do a snow hike, and you know, I looked at this friend of mine, it was kind of like the light went on. I says, I think I know now what to do. So we went out there, just the two of us this time, and we walked out of that field into the woods. We found a place where the snow had drifted up into the trees, and there was a big bank of snow there, and we just kind of tunneled in real tight to that bank and then dug down enough, built a little fire pit on the end, little toasty fire, slept in there that night, absolutely comfortable, had a top on it, brought a tarp with us, laid out branches, laid the tarp, packed snow over the top to seal it on the top, all out of sight, no wind. It was so warm in there, we got up in the morning, you could take your tin cup and scrape slush off the walls to make your chocolate for breakfast. You know, there's a lot of difference in having just a little bit of knowledge. You can be in the same place, you can be building a sandcastle or a pier, you can be doing the same thing, but with a little bit of knowledge and experience, a little bit of wisdom, you can do some remarkable and wonderful things. 1 John 4, verse number 20. Remember, the purpose of the family is so that God gave us an institution that would be the place where we would learn to love our neighbor as such, love our mates, love our children. 1 John 4, verse number 20. If someone says, I love God and hates his brother, he's a liar, for he doesn't love his brother whom he has seen. If he doesn't, how can he love God whom he has not seen? This commandment have we from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also. Now in the Bible, our fellow man is our brother. And so we think about this all the time. You know, there's all kinds of principles in the Bible. Go to your brother. We call each other brethren. Where does the analogy come from? It comes from the family. It comes from the fact that a family has brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers, and that's where you have a brother as such by the analogy, and that's extended biblically into the Bible. Love your brother must apply in our family first, in our home first. To apply it in the church, or to apply it in society, or to apply it with our neighbors, but not to apply it at home, is fraud. That's where the basis of the analogy comes from. Our service to God starts in our homes, And what we do in the church is supposed to have actually started there. And that will then take us, that's what God gave us, to prepare us to be in the family of God. But the love that is, as we apply it in the sense, in terms of community or the church, is the love that is supposed to first and foremost be there in our homes. Doesn't matter how many church programs we have. Doesn't matter what kind of programs we have. They will never replace a proper home. Imperial schools never did teach the children to turn to God if indeed the family and the home was not teaching the children themselves. The church is a support system for the family. The family is not a support system for the church. The family is not an extension of the church. The church is an extension of it. Josh McDowell would probably faint if he knew I was reading his material, but he has some good material. He'd be surprised that I would probably choose it. I want to read you a little bit of something that came from one of his books, Right from Wrong, back in 1994, and some of the comments that he made that are so close to point. He says, our children are not adopting our values and our morals. They don't share our priorities and perspectives, and we can't blame the media, we can't blame society or government or the Supreme Court, and you can't blame the public schools. They're not entrusted with communicating biblical values to our children. We are. He says, we must not expect to change our culture as if we could. We must change the way, though, we respond to it. It does no good to bemoan our society. We must control how much we allow it, though, to influence us and our children. You see, we can't blame television and movies for what our kids believe or how they behave because we've allowed the media to influence them. We've used the tube to babysit our toddlers and entertain our teens. We've been too lazy or disinterested to preview movies for our children instead of relying on a rating system to tell us what they should watch. I'm saying that Christian parents need to take responsibility for the influences we allow in our kids' lives. We need to help them filter advertising messages. We need to help them evaluate the subtle and not so subtle media messages in movies, television shows, newscasts, and songs. We need to use the media as a tool to teach or reinforce moral lessons. To the degree that we have failed to do these things, we have failed to meet our parental responsibility. Is it easy? No, it's not easy. Can you always do it? I don't think you always can, but should we do it as much as possible? Obviously, we should. One thing that has always kind of mystified me in the church is when a parent, in some ways, either consciously or subconsciously, wants me to replace them in some element of their teenager's life. We were on a camp out a few years ago with teenagers, and I took them all, and we went out and had a great time, and we were camped on a river and decided we'd all go swimming. One of the girls gets out her bikini and jumps into it and runs for the beach. And I was stunned. Here was this skimpy little bikini with hanging out, you know, breasts hanging out the top and heading over there. And I didn't believe for a minute that mom and daddy had never seen it in their life, that it was totally secreted away and that they had no idea whatsoever. No, mommy and daddy had been pressured into adjusting what they believed because sometimes it just gets too tough. And now all of a sudden I'm in a position where a responsible activity is taking place that I'm in charge of, and I have to now address the issue for them. It's not fair, it's not right, and it's not what the family was for. I've seen that dynamic take place in different ways in the church at times. It doesn't happen as a whole, but it does happen. Those are family issues. Some say, well, don't worry about it in the church, it doesn't matter. Well, it does matter. It is important. People do get offended. Issues are sensitive. We need to be modest, whether we are men or women. It applies sometimes in different ways. But we need to do that, and it is our personal responsibility, and we cannot foist that off on the church or each other or the pastor. We as parents need to take responsibility for those areas of authority God has given us. The Bible says children are a heritage of the Lord. That means God delegates their upkeep and upbringing to us. We are raising our children for Him. And the example as well that we set needs to be in accordance with that. Josh McDowell continues, here and now we need to acknowledge that it is our responsibility, not the cultures, not the schools, not the church, to equip our children with a bedrock of biblical values that will enable them to make moral choices in an immoral world. We must take time with our children. Leave the briefcase at work. Forget your favorite television show. Let the garden go for a few days. Our garden has been let go for a few days anyway. It's the way our garden starts. Begin now to teach them when they rise up, when they're in the way, when they lie down to rest, drawing an analogy to Deuteronomy. Children, he says, are a heritage of the Lord. They are a gift, a trust, and my daily, hourly responsibility is to raise them in nurture and admonition of the Lord. God gave us the family to prepare us for the family of God. It is the environment, it is the medium, it is the gift God gave us in that sense to learn how to love each other, to love our children, and to prepare each of us for the kingdom of God. It's an incredible thing. It's not just our children. Well, those issues are very, very sensitive in the family as well. It's our marriages. Even in society, marriage has a fundamental impact on the way society functions as a whole. Outside of the church, 3/4 of all the abortions that take place in the United States take place outside of marriage. 3/4. Many of the marriages that are out there aren't even good ones. In fact, there's a lot of lousy marriages out there and in here. But even out there, in a lousy marriage, and I don't mean in a situation that's threatening in some way that's wrong or unbiblical or ungodly. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about even in those that are maybe limited in their fulfillment. Still, the abortion rate is severely reduced. And there are many other factors in that. But 3/4 of all the abortions in the U.S. that take place are outside of marriage because there's no medium there. There's no element there. There's no way to handle and process those things, and so they go for the worst option. Our marriages need to be good ones. Our children need to be loved, to feel loved. Our homes need to be refuges. Our families need to be places of safety. How many of us have yearned to go to the place of safety? A place where the church could be protected in times of trial and tribulation before Christ returns. How many times we focused on that, wanting indeed, say, fine, I'll leave tomorrow if God would, you know, wrap it up now, let's go. Well, but we're not leaving yet. And the place of safety that God intends us to have is the one that we have control of here, and it needs to be indeed a refuge. It needs to be a pier, not a sandcastle, not something that's at risk that'll wash back out to sea. Now, I'm going to tell you, and you know, and I've made comment, Michelle and I work at our marriage, and we work at our family, and it isn't always rosy for either one of us, but we try. We do try. And sometimes it's painful to us both. The marriage, the family, the children, all of those things are things that God gave us for lessons to learn. Some of those lessons are quite painful. But they're lessons we need to be at least willing to learn. Nick Stinnett had an article. He wrote a book, if I can find my notes on it. He was the dean of the Graduate School of Education and Psychology at Pepperdine University in L.A., and he wrote a book, Secrets of Strong Families. He went through and he analyzed families that were together and committed and strong and nurturing environments. And he went through and he analyzed the elements that were there. He said there was a high sense of commitment. There was a family identity, the concept of being on a team, concept of unity, striving for the same things. There was a concept, very high valuation of appreciation, that they valued each other and each other's feeling of need and positive commitment to that group was strengthened. Communication was a very high priority. A lot of time talking, a lot of time listening. He says, as a result, the family members felt closer and less isolated. They didn't feel, in that sense, emotionally abandoned or adrift or alone. They felt like there was at least a communication process that took place. And he says, you know, those families that are strong spend a lot of time together. They eat together, they work together, they play and talk together. And when outside demands are made on their time and energy, As is necessary, they eliminate obligations and involvements and give priority to the family wherever they can. He says those elements in a family foster a spiritual health. It fosters an environment where the family is able to develop love and compassion and develop, in that sense, a spiritual strong base as well in that family. And he said there's one other element that comes out of that is the ability to learn to cope. He said in a family like that, the children grow up because in terms of crisis, the family pulls together, because the family is flexible against obstacles, because the family continues on. They begin to trust in that, and they begin to mimic that in their own personal relationships outside of the family. The children grow up learning to cope with problems with their friends and in this society today. I thought it was interesting, the elements that he addressed. We need to have a very high level of commitment, a very high level of appreciation, so that the family units within the church are indeed units. They're not a collection of individual identities and separate desires. They're actually units. Now, the fact is, a man and a woman are so far apart on some issues that I wonder how God did this. I it's funny, but I mean that as seriously as I can say it. Sometimes I wonder, how did God do this? It's like he took all the green and he put it here and all the red and he put it here, and there's no green or red that mixed. But what he intended, obviously, was that out of that, sometimes in a way that is hard and difficult, God intended us to be more like him. And I think he literally separated out his nature in such a way that he expected us to have to really enter through, in that sense, a straight gate, a narrow pass, and to be willing to strive to develop and to form in the realm of a family environment and culture what he absolutely intended. I'm trying to prepare to go to camp. I'm teaching rock climbing at camp. Ha, ha. I'm not actually teaching. There are individuals who are credentialed that will teach rock climbing. I'm going to Challenger Camp, an individual who's credentialed that will teach rappelling. But I have done some climbing and rappelling in the past, and it's been a few years. And so I'm really just basically overseeing the department. And in the actual classes, I'll assist those individuals. But at my advanced age, I'm trying to get back into shape and do some climbing again. And we went out this last week. And I was going up a rock section that had an overhang at the top. And I went out with an instructor so I could just go one-on-one and spend some time actively that way. And I got right to the overhang, and I kept saying, you know, I don't know how to get over an overhang. And he says, oh, you'll do it just fine. And I got up there. This was not the first climb of the day, so I was kind of tired. And I went up the overhang, and the rock just goes up like this, and then it kind of curves out like that. And I didn't know what to do. And basically, I got up there and I just hung on till I fell off. Absolutely screaming pain in my arms as I was trying to hold on to this last stage. Of course, I'm on a rope and it's not like I hit the ground, so I just went on down. And then he says, watch this. And I watched him go up, and he went up the same section that I did the first part, and you could figure that out. There's cracks and little footholds, and you can kind of worm your way up and pressure your body back and forth. And he got to the overhang. And then he got up to where I did, and then he put his hands up where I had, and I watched. And then he just kicked his foot out. And on the side of that rock, rock climbing shoes are real soft rubber, and they stick almost. He just kicked his foot out so that he could move his weight back to his legs. And there was probably a little tiny piece of rock sticking out, no bigger than a half inch, but it was enough to just put side pressure on his legs where he could lift up and go over the top. And I thought, I'll never make that mistake again. I'm here hanging on to the same spot with all my weight on my arms over my head till I dropped. He goes up and simply kicks a foot to the side, supports his weight with a little bit of wisdom and knowledge and experience, and he was up and over the top. You know, we need to simply know what it is we need to do. It's not always easy, but we need to be willing to strive to do it. We need to try to proceed in that sense in a way that will strengthen the family and complete the task. It's easy to just not climb. It's easy to just not try. When I was single, I didn't know how selfish I was. I just didn't understand how selfish that could be. I could do what I want, when I wanted, if I wanted. If I wanted to work somewhere else, I could go and work there. If I wanted to stay up, I'd stay up, go to bed, and I fulfilled my obligation. But my life in that sense was simpler than I understood. The family doesn't allow much for that. The family of marriage does not allow much for that. I mean, it puts demands on us to do things that we don't want to do when we don't want to do it, in ways that we're not really desirous of. And yet, it's a process we must go through. God gave it to us as His gift. And He gave us the Word of God, and He gave us the Holy Spirit so that we could stop and learn what the importance of the process is, and then begin to do it in a way where it would right and properly take place. Sometimes, in a family environment, in a marriage environment, we break down that commitment and appreciation to the point that we don't really care if we hold on or not. And again, I'm not talking about abuse in a circumstance which is, you know, the Bible gives qualifications for the breakdown of a family in certain ways. It addresses those issues. I don't want to address that today. I want to address what's in the Good News magazine. I want to address bringing up a moral child. I want to address raising good children in a bad world. I want to address something that is, at least in this area, supportive of that title and heading. I want to address the strengthening of the families that we have as we have option to do so. We should never use words that reduce the commitment in the marriage or in the family. We should never use the word divorce as a threat. We should never use words like, if you don't like it, then leave, as a threat, because it reduces the commitment. It says, I don't care if we face the issues here. We don't even have to face the issues here. If you don't like it, then just leave. It's over. You know, if you have a problem, address the problem. Don't compromise moral values in the process, but be willing to sacrifice for the common good. We got a call not too long ago. Megan had a friend in Lubbock as a little girl. It was probably the best friend that she had. And she found out over the phone that this little girl's parents had just been divorced. Now, we just left in January and didn't even know there was a problem. At least on that scale, we knew there was a problem, but Megan didn't know there was a problem. All she knew is there was a little girl and friends who were happy as far as she understood. And when Megan found out that night, she cried herself to sleep. Now, we held her, and we tried to encourage her, and we tried to console her, and she still cried herself to sleep. You know what that made her feel like? It made her feel like maybe the same thing would happen to us, because she has mates at school that are in such a position as that. And so as she sees this around her more and more, and as she sees it in her friends, it really made her even afraid and fearful to a degree that it would happen to us. We need to help our families to feel wanted, to feel needed, to be secure. Nick Stinnett in his article said, you know, families have to simply do things together, do projects together, do set goals together, make the rules together. You've got to be willing to engage. If you don't want to engage, then don't start the process. If you already started the process and you're in the process, then you must engage. If you will not, you do not fulfill your obligation before God to be producing His family on this earth in preparation for the family of God in the kingdom. What does God want us to do? To engage with Him. He calls us, and He wants us to respond, and He wants us to continue to respond more and more and build relationship with Him. That process is not done in a vacuum. Can't be done in a vacuum. Michelle really enjoys, you go into a supermarket and they have sometimes little carts for the kids, and the kids are all running around banging into people and throwing food on the floor, and Michelle just loves that. Not because of the damage and destruction in the wake of the cart, but because here's a child doing what mommy's doing or what daddy's doing, and it makes them feel like they're a part of it. Now, all the stores in Lubbock had those carts, and we'd go in, and the kids would race for the carts, and off they'd go, and we'd put a box in here and something in there, and it was wonderful. You know, we had a little toy mower. And we'd be out mowing, and Derek would be following along, you know, right next to me with a little toy mower. And we had one that blew bubbles and didn't last very long, and that's the way most toys are. They look good until you use them. But there are things like that, that they build unity, they build commitment, they build strength. You know, there's few things in this world that are more valuable to a child than confidence. My children and our children, but I'm addressing it from what happens to me, when they need confidence, they come up and they want me to touch them. They want to hold my hand. They want me to pick them up. They just want to touch me for a while. It's like I'm transferring something to them. It's a sign of my love for them that they can touch me. And then when they kind of have enough of that, then they go off and they run. And when they're in a new environment, they huddle closer. They want to be touched more and hugged more, and it's their security. And it gives them confidence to go back out into the world. Well, the family unit has to do that for the whole. It has to build that kind of confidence. There has to be that kind of touch. It has to have that kind of contact and emotional contact so that the family can go back out as well and not be threatened or challenged or, in that sense, cast aside. Few things are more valuable to a child than confidence. To not be afraid to raise their hand or to ask questions or to try something new. You know, I am not a natural parent. I struggle with it. I absolutely struggle with it. But I must. What choice do I have? I have no choice at all. You know, I tell you, my concept of a parent was what happened with my son Brad. I was out the door. 19 years later, I had to stop and give account. But that was my initial concept of a parent. Our children and our family members need to feel like, indeed, that they are part of something that is valued and useful and important. There was a book I read some time ago, and the title was All You Ever Needed to Read. It says, Husbands, do yourselves a favor, love your wives. You could throw the book away. Just take that cover, tear it off, and stick it on the wall. Now, you could do it from the reverse, whatever it is. But husbands, do yourselves a favor. Don't smash your toe. Do yourselves a favor. Don't cut your arm off. Do yourself a favor. Don't hit yourself in the face. Do yourself a favor. Love your wife. Just, you know, go ahead. Make it easy on yourself. Now, when I was in high school, we had a system where the last two grades, I guess first the last three grades were together, then the last two grades were together as they built in their schools. But I went into science class one day, the first day I'd ever been in there, never met my teacher before, Mr. Finkbein. And he sat up at the front of the class, and I sat down, and I was an average student, not great. I was like a 2.7, 2.8 on a four-point scale. So I was, in that sense, I was a C student in high school, didn't apply myself much. And I got into his class, and he said, well, you know, students, anybody have a question? And I don't know what happened to me that day, but I decided to ask a question. You know, normally I just kind of sit there and daydream or something, but I decided to ask a question. And so I raised my hand and I asked a question, and you know, he said something so simple. He said, boy, he didn't say boy, he said, well, that's a very good question. And I thought, wow,
thank you.
So he answered my question. I asked him another one. I thought, well, this is easy, you know, it's like getting pieces of candy, you know, people just hand to you. He said, wow, that's a very good question. I'll tell you why, it's important to the class. And so I asked two or three questions. You know what I got in his class? I got an A. I got an A because I killed myself for him, because once he showed me that kind of support and attention, I decided that I really wanted that, and I began to pursue it. And I did extra credit papers, and I turned in all these extra points, and I just blew an A clear out of the water. I had so many extra credit points that I wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even a question. In fact, he had to change the extra credit program because I basically ruined the system. He said you could get 25 points for turning in reports on certain things. 25 points. I got thinking about that, and I said, that's interesting. You see, you get 100 points for a test, and I get 25 points for the special project. So I remember I wrote a report on Karari poison. I remember the report, some of these things. I started cranking these reports in. Man, I had points coming out. I mean, I could have skipped the tests and got an A. I had so many extra credit points. He had to change the whole system because of what I did. But you know, it started out with him just basically saying, boy, good job. Good question. I really think that's wonderful. I appreciate that. And I was off. Job 16 kind of addresses that process. Job 16. I'm afraid to look at Michelle. She'll be down there going, now Mark. Job 16. It says, Job answered and said, I've heard many such things. And his friends are attacking him, telling him what a bozo he is, indigent, how sinful he's been. I've heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. Shall words of wind have an end? When are you going to shut up? What provokes you to such an answer as that? If I could speak as you do, if your soul were in my soul's place, I could heap up words against you. I could remind you of the things that you have done, and I could shake my head at you. He says, but I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the comfort of my lips would relieve your grief. He says, if I could speak to you, I would try to encourage you instead. We need to give praise for accomplishments more than we are so quick to give correction sometimes for failures. You know, if I drop a glass in the house or bump something and knock it over, you know what it is? It's a mistake. You know what it is if somebody else does it? Carelessness. But if I do it, it's just a mistake. And we need to understand that process. We need to accept the fact that somebody else might be just carelessness, or it's forgivable, it's acceptable, it's not going to kill us. Deuteronomy 24, verse number 5, is an interesting principle. Deuteronomy 24, 5 says, when a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war or be charged with any business because he'll have plenty of it at home. No, it doesn't say that, does it? He's got all he needs right there. When a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war or be charged with any business. He shall be free at home 1 year and bring happiness to the wife whom he has taken. His responsibility, his job, is to produce and provide an environment that is going to establish that family in a strong way, so that when war does come and he is necessary to go, or when business does require and he's necessary to go, that he can go and take care of those things, and the family will have enough nurture and commitment to sustain those times. But you don't start out with trial and test, ideally. Now, some of us did, some of us have. That's just simply not a wise or proper thing to do. You know, I've mentioned before in a sermon, the Bible says a husband should love his wife. It says a wife should respect and deeply admire in that sense. The husband can't demand the wife to respect him, and the wife can't demand the husband to love her. They both have to be willing to love and respect and to admire and give that on their own. And it doesn't mean it's easy, doesn't mean it's nice, doesn't mean it feels good. It doesn't feel good sometimes. It feels pretty bad. But if we have to demand that the other fulfill their part for we'll fill ours, then many times that's mutually exclusive and it never takes place. It just never takes place. Those things that we say are very, very important, and the way we say them is very, very important. Proverbs 16, verse 21. The wise in heart will be called prudent, and sweetness of the lips increases learning. The things we say and the way we say it actually are going to, if it's nicely done, increase the impact of what we say. Sweetness of lips increases learning. People will try harder, they'll do more, they'll accomplish more, they'll produce, they'll increase. And who's the beneficiary? We all are. Verse 23, the heart of the wise teaches his mouth and adds learning to his lips. Pleasant words are like honeycomb. Sweetness to the soul, health to the bones. You know, funny thing, I went to bed one night depressed. Anybody here ever been depressed? Nah. Went to bed one night depressed and got up with a backache. I thought, why, isn't that strange? Went to bed depressed, let myself kind of cycle down a bit, figured, forget it, going to bed, I don't care, I'll go to sleep. Woke up in the morning, something was wrong. And I thought, that's strange. And I began to wonder, if I'd have gone to bed happy, if the same thing would have happened. Or if I'd have gone to bed at peace in my mind, if the same thing would have happened. You know, we all know that our thoughts trigger enzymes and chemicals and all kinds of things in our brain and in our body, and that there is a process. And we all know that a spirit in an individual who is sick sometimes indeed can give them the strength and the courage to have the stamina to fight off whatever disease or sickness that they have. We all know that some people give up and simply die. We know those things. God just says the sweetness of the lips increases learning and understanding. It's like honeycomb, sweetness to the mouth. It's health to the bones. Michelle used to work for a man when we were in Los Angeles, and she worked for a man that was so critical of her that he would stand over her while she typed and wait for the page to come out, and then if she made a mistake, he'd tell her. How many mistakes you think she made? I mean, it went berserk. Mistakes just went right out the wall. And finally she had to quit. She couldn't work for him because he was so critical of her that she became what he expected and what he treated her like. You just couldn't work around it. Communication is a problem for some of our families these days. For all of us to some degree, probably. We need to spend the time to talk and to listen. If when someone in our family talks to us, if our response is a judgment, then communication likely will cease. Likely it will cease. You only communicate where you have safe haven to do so, generally in the family context. If we listen in order to answer, in other words, if we're listening, waiting to respond, then communication is also going to cease. We'll go with a friend, we'll be with a friend, and we will not judge that friend. Then why do we sit and judge each other so tightly and so critically sometimes in our family units as well? It's simply a disaster to do so, brethren. The family, because we are so close, we can easily hurt each other, but we can also do each other much good. Psalm 55 is an account here of, I think it was David, in verse number 12, it is David. He says, it was not an enemy who reproached me, I could have borne that. It's not one who hated me, who has magnified himself against me. You know, if somebody who opposed me or had done this thing to me with somebody I didn't really care about or somebody that was kind of outside, I'd have kind of protected myself from him. I'd have given him some distance. I could have hid from him, but it was you, a man, my equal, my companion, my acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together, walked to the house of God in the throng. David's just saying, look, it was somebody inside the circle, somebody I was intimate with, personal with. I exposed myself to you, and you injured me. And he says, it hurt. It hurt beyond understanding. Our families are like that. We're intimate. We're open. We expose ourselves to each other. We must be incredibly careful in the way we say the things that we say. Communication is so important to be willing to process. If we're not willing to communicate in a marriage, then what are we married? Why are we there? Did we make a mistake? I made a mistake. I made a mistake. I had a son came out of a mistake that I made. It took me 19 years to be in a position to have to own up to that. And what would I do? What should I have done? Say, well, look, I'm sorry. I can't handle this. I'm sorry. No, I don't want to do this. This isn't right. It doesn't suit my lifestyle. What am I going to do? I didn't have a choice. When God finally showed me what I had to do, I had to then do it. And it wasn't something that necessarily was the brightest opportunity in the world by human standards. But what else can we do? We're there. We're in it. It's done. Friends of ours were dating around, not even dating each other, but they were friends with each other. And they would go out and they would date on the side, and no, it wouldn't really work out, and something would come crashing down, and they'd come back and they'd talk about it, and they'd pour their heart out to each other, they really consoled each other as friends. And this went on for a period of time, and they never really found happiness or friendship in the way they wanted in their other circle of friends. And then one day they kind of looked at each other and says, I talk to you and you listen, and you talk to me and I listen, and we get along, and we don't really judge each other, but we're helpful to each other. And they go, They start dating. They start dating each other, and you know, they got married. They got married because they looked around and all these other things they wanted and all these other people they wanted to be with and pursue. And then they stopped and they says, you know, what do we really want? Well, we want to be friends. Well, we are friends. Well, that's interesting. And they got married. And they were happy. And it was a remarkable thing. What used to be one of the times in this country and in this culture years ago where the family sat down together and talked? When was it? Was it at the mealtime? Wasn't it at dinner? I think that's part of the culture that has existed in the past. You could talk over the day's activities. Then along came work schedules that varied. Then along came television and other activities and began to intrude into the family in that way. We need to still make an effort here to have time when the family sits together in a relaxed atmosphere and talks in a way that is non-threatening and supportive. But if you sit down at dinner with your family and begin to talk about the day, don't address your problems there. Don't correct the issues of the day there. That's not what it's for. That's probably the worst time that could ever be chosen to bring up a problem in a family is over a meal. In church, we ought to make Friday nights and the Sabbath special. You know, church isn't a children activity. We know that. We've tried it. We've got a gym. We've got the teens and their own separate activity, the children here. My children don't want to sit up in church and listen to me speak again. They don't want to do it. They're tired. It's not exciting on their scale, but they're here. We need to, where we can, make Friday nights and Sabbath special in any other way we can. This morning I was preparing my notes and going over my notes and getting ready for church, and Megan came down and told me, or Derek, I guess, came down and told me breakfast was served upstairs, and I'm thinking, I don't have time for breakfast. I'll just get a plate, and I'll go back down in my office, and I'll be working. And I went up and get a plate, and here the table's set with a tablecloth, and the dishes are out, and I mean, it was all set for special, and you know, I was too embarrassed to eat down in my office. I sat down at the table and had breakfast. I'm still here. I still was ready. I'll probably go overtime even. No, I'll try not. But yeah, I still, life worked on and went on okay. I survived. Had breakfast with my family. We need to do things that draw our families together, things that we can. This life fractured. I got a brother in Connecticut. I got a brother in Texas. I got a brother in Seattle. I got a mom in Oregon. And yeah, we get together all the time, sure. You know, we don't. Society has pushed our families apart in so many ways. We need to do things that pull our families back together. We planted a garden this year, except you might not call it a garden. There is some green things coming out of it. Half of them are weeds. We'll learn. We haven't had gardens as a family for... Well, let's see, how long we live in Texas? 6 years. Yeah, we haven't had a garden as long as we lived in Texas. We grew cactus in Texas. Michelle went out with the kids. I tilled it all up, and then Michelle went out with the kids and planted all the seeds, and then she made a chart on the wall and glued each little seed on there, and they put down when it would sprout and what to expect in all these little places. And Megan goes out there now, because we've told Megan when we lived in Nebraska that Megan and I, after she was born, would go out to the garden there and pick fresh corn and eat breakfast in the garden. We'd sit down and eat the corn. We've told her this all her life. Well, she's never had a corn patch, and we got these stalks of corn now pushing up. She's heard this for years. And now, in fact, this morning, she says, Daddy, when is the corn going to be ready? She wants to now go out and sit in the corn and break an ear off and sit there and eat it for breakfast with me. And I want to do it. I want to try that. We got spinach coming up a little bit. We picked some last night, just a couple sprigs, and snacked on it. But, you know, we need to find things that draw us together, that remind us of the importance of our family that is there. When Michelle was pregnant with Megan, we lived there in Omaha, and the little neighbor boy was over at the house, and Michelle was planting tulips in the beds. And she told the little boy, she gave him a tulip bulb. She says, you go home and get your mommy and you plant this tulip bulb. When it comes up and there's a tulip, she says, I'll have a baby. So he kind of toddled off home, and I didn't think that much about it, but that next spring, that was in the fall, next spring, she comes home, we come home, she's got a baby, and in the course of time, I walked out in the back patio and I looked around and looked up to the neighbor's house, and right by the back porch, there was one tulip. One tulip there in bloom, and I thought about that, and she had given that little boy that tulip and said, go talk to your mommy and you go plant that in your garden, and when that's in bloom, I'll have a baby. And I don't know, I think of things like that sometimes, and Megan and Derek want to go rock climbing now. They're just dying to go rock climbing. And so I said, fine, I'll take them. We'll get them a little harness, and I'll take them down and drop them off the wall. Derek's always asking me to build something or take something apart. Always asking me, Daddy, can we, you know, we go buy a yard sale. He wants to buy a piece of junk so Daddy and him can take it apart, take all the screws out, take everything apart, just gut it. And he's happy for about a day. You know, if I can't find to do those things, if I'm not willing to do those things, I mean, they're just not, if Michelle doesn't participate in some of those ways too, I mean, our families, our kids aren't going to be able to cope. They're not going to have security. They're not, I mean, they're insecure enough just by living with us. And if we mortgage the rest of it, what'll they ever have? A man in the church had a business in his home one time, had a son who socially was not really accepted, kind of outside of the popularity circle at school, but he desperately wanted to learn to do what his dad did, and his dad did it right there in the basement, and I just couldn't believe that this man in the church would actually cut his son out of what he was doing there and would not teach his son his trade. You know, when your son helps you, it takes twice as long. I know that. And it's only half as good when you're done, in a technical sense. But you know, that process increases as you go, and what you're building is not the gun in your basement. What you're building is a child of God and the family of God. That's what you're building. You're building character. You're building a child who makes moral choices. You're building a child who is sensitive and loves and nurtures and is willing to when, you know, when he has a child, willing to take time to spend time with him. You have a ripple effect through your entire generations of family. And you want to just destroy a family tree, well, then just do damage to the ones right up front. It's an incredible process. There's a term, too, that I just sometimes makes me itch a little bit when I hear it, this term, quality time. The concept is true, but the fact is it's used in the context of we're so busy and we got so many things to do and we have so many other priorities than our families that if we'll just give them a few moments of absolute time where we focus on them a couple minutes a day, they'll be all right, and they won't. They might survive, but they won't be right, not the way they should have been. Psalm 127 hangs on our wall in home. Michelle painted it. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. You remember Nick Stinnett was saying, you know, if there's certain elements in the family that are there, if there's a commitment, if there's appreciation, if time is spent together, if some of these things are fulfilled, it provides an environment that will nurture these children that come along. God can be involved in that process in a way that is stronger than otherwise. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. You can work as hard as you want, but you can't guarantee you'll have production in the way you desire, because unless God is involved, it's a crapshoot to some degree. To some degree. There's still physical principles that will apply. It says, behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. Heritage, an inheritance, something God gave us to take care of, to be responsible for. The fruit of the womb is His reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. It means you could actually take them and direct them to a target. That's the whole concept of that portion of the passage. It's like an arrow to a warrior. You can shoot it at something, and you can hit the point. Will you never miss? No, sometimes you'll miss. But the straighter the arrow, and the more practice you have shooting that arrow, and the more you focus on the target, the closer you'll be to home. Paul talked to Timothy and reminded him that as a child, that he had the example of his mother, he had the example of his grandmother, and their example gave him opportunity for God to call him and use him ministerially in the church. Now, whether it's ministerial or not doesn't matter. It's simply the fact that in Timothy, that was what took place. It gave God a chance to work with Timothy and call him to be a part of his family in the kingdom. It says that he learned about God as a child. As a child, he began to learn about God. We need to build some resilience into our families if we can, and our children feed on us. Is that tough? It's absolutely tough. It's a good thing I ate breakfast or I'd be way over. Len Judd was here for Pentecost, my cousin, Gloria. They visited us and they attended with us here. But Len had never been backpacking. And so I took him backpacking one time. This was going to be a real treat. Do you ever remember a few years ago how all of Arizona flooded? And there was big floods on the Gila River down in Phoenix and out there in Yuma and out in these areas. There were floods all through Arizona. And well, that was the year I took him backpacking. And I took him up in the Gila Wilderness up in New Mexico, which was the headwaters of that river that flooded half of Arizona. And it was running pretty high up there, too. And there was a lot of water. And the night before we were getting ready to hike in, we had to hike in 12 miles to where camp was. The night before, I got sick and had to go to the emergency room. And, of course, the emergency room was back in town. That was like an hour and a half away or something, back drive down. And so we were up all night, didn't sleep at all. I spent part of the night in the emergency room, and in the morning I was better. So we came back out to camp, decided to go ahead and hike in anyway. Well, we're kind of punked out, 12 miles to go. It's raining. Trail was wet, so the trail was muddy. You know, it clumps up on your shoes, and you're carrying extra poundage on every step. And we're hauling in all this gear. And we got in about 9 miles that day and climbing this long ridge. And this is the first time he'd ever packed in his life. And he, of course, later he said it was the best time he'd ever had. No. And a storm blew up late afternoon, and lightning was crashing. And we knew we had to stop and make camp. There was no way out. We were on a ridge. We couldn't get any further with the storm and everything, and it was late, and we were afraid we'd get stuck on some outcropping. And so we're on this narrow ridge where it drops off literally on both sides. Pitched our tent. Storm crashes down. We're muddy. It was my tent. I'd used it for years. Apparently it was wore out and didn't know it. We got inside, and water was running through the tent, coming down the seams. There was so much water in the tent, zipped up, we had to cut a hole in the bottom of the floor. It was on the side of a hill, so the water would run back out the other side of the tent. There was mud in there. We had our sleeping bags and gear. We had it all packed up on the top end, trying to keep it dry. Lightning was crashing so close to us that there was no difference between the flash and the report. It was instantaneous. Lightning bolts were striking within 50 yards of the tent on that ridge, crashing. You could feel the blast from the lightning as it hits, you know. You felt that concussion when you're close. And we're laying up there, and of course, I'm embarrassed. This is my tent, and I'm the one that set up the trip, and he's kind of going with me, and he turned and looked at me. I'm waiting for the wrath of Khan, you know. And he turned and looked at me and says, you know, it just doesn't get any better than this. I appreciated that so much. He could have said anything, and he says, it just doesn't get any better than this. You know, he acted like he was sitting down to a steak and a potato and a glass of wine at a nice restaurant. And I'm just telling you, I'll appreciate that probably to the day I die. Family sometimes like that. Lightning's crashing down around us. It's rain washing in and out of our little tent. There's mud and our bedrolls rolled up on one end. And life gets like that. And you know, at those times, it doesn't help to stop and begin to fight and accuse and to lay blame and judgment. Sometimes you got to be willing to say, well, family, here we are. Doesn't get any better than this. We made a video of that, and the title is that. It doesn't get any better than this, and I watch it, and we laugh, and it's fun, and times pass, and life goes on. But we need to build some resilience into our families by our own example. You know, everything we do becomes an option for our children. When we're abusive, they often become abusive. When we're disrespectful, they're often disrespectful. But when we show restraint, then they often show restraint as well. God is the one who is ultimately building the family, and he has chosen to build it through us. He has chosen to build it through us. God created the family to instill his character into our minds. Each one of us participates in that process. Each one of us is a part of the family that God is working through. The purpose of the human family is to prepare us to be part of the family of God, and let's be sure as much as we possibly can that that purpose is being fulfilled.